This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Donald Trump has emboldened untold numbers of anti-Muslim Americans by declaring his proposed ban on Muslims as part of his bizarre presidential campaign. It's hard to take Trump seriously, except that enough Americans do take him seriously. Today, we intend on making light of Trump and his ilk with my guest, Negin Farsad, who has used the reactionary fear of Muslims in the United States as a central trope in her comedy. She has co-directed and produced a documentary called The Muslims Are Coming, which is when I first met her. Farsad now has a new book out. It's an autobiography of sorts that happens to be incredibly hilarious. It's called How to Make White People Laugh. Negin Farsad is an Iranian-American Muslim comedian, a TED Senior Fellow. She has written for or appeared on Comedy Central, MTV, PBS, IFC, Nickelodeon, and much more. She was named one of the 53 funniest women by Huffington Post, and she now joins me. Welcome to the program, Negin.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, 53 funniest women, not 50 funniest women, but 53 funniest women.
I wanted to make the list very unique, so and maybe I was number 51, you know, so I'm glad they did.
How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm here in New York City, so if you hear the sound of traffic in the distance, that's why.
So when I first got a hold of your book and I saw the cover, I mean, even not knowing your background and who you were, I was definitely drawn to it because of the bold title, How to Make White People Laugh. But when I realized it was you, and having been familiar with your work with Dino Bidala, with the Muslims Are Coming documentary, I definitely knew it would be quality. But let's talk about this idea, How to Make White People Laugh. You start out your book talking about how the black-white dichotomy has been kind of confusing for you as a child, and you grew up kind of considering yourself black. That's very weird. You're clearly not black, at least for a TV audience. You're Iranian, you're brown like me. But how did that happen? And how old were you when you started sort of suspecting you might be black?
So this wasn't a Rachel Dolezal situation, just to be clear. Like, I wasn't delusional. I wasn't trying to pass. I didn't actually think I was black. Like, I knew I wasn't black. But I think, you know, because the race conversation has been so binary since the inception of this country, everything has been very black or white. And then if you are just a member of a group that is not black or white, you know, you're kind of left out of like the larger discourse on race and ethnicity. And so, and then I think, you know, in especially in the southwestern United States in recent decades, the Mexican identity has also made a splash. And so that kind of has creeped into our cultural consciousness. And so for me, I think when I was growing up, I grew up in Southern California, I longed to be Mexican because everybody understood Mexicans. Mexicans had all of the radio stations, they had restaurants, they had cultural icons, you know what I mean? They had people like Cesar Chavez, And on the kind of lower, crappier end, they also had the Chihuahua, the Taco Bell Chihuahua. So there's but they were kind of had infiltrated popular culture in a way that Iranian American Muslim ladies had not. And so I think, you know, for people that are like me who are part of an underpopulated ethnic minority, you sort of glom onto the closest larger minority group, you know. And so for me as a kid, I was like, I'm not Mexican, but close enough, you know, and that's kind of the feeling that I kind of grew up with. And then in college, that transformed into, you know, there were no Mexicans where I went to school in upstate New York. So that kind of transformed into, you know, identifying with the black struggle. And again, it was one of those things where I was like, I know I'm not black, but I felt like affiliating myself with the black struggle, fighting for the black struggle, because it just felt kind of Iranian American Muslim adjacent. and so that's kind of that explains the identity confusion.
And you studied under Manning Marable. You have a very serious educational background that kind of belies your comedy career. You've majored in was it a master's in black studies, but also public policy?
Yeah. I know. I got two master's degrees, which are a must-have for any comedian. And I really, you know, because I wanted to be I wanted to go into politics. I wanted to level the playing field. I wanted to do that through public policy. And in fact, my first job coming out of graduate school was as a policy analyst for the campaign finance board. And so I was really trying to be a serious adult, you know what I mean, with a stable income and pantsuits. But that sort of didn't, you know, but I was doing comedy the whole time. I was doing comedy all during high school, during college, during grad school. I would like leave study groups and I would be like, I don't know what you guys are doing with this like studying thing, but I have a set downtown, so I better go do some comedy. And so I was always like the odd bird, kind of maintaining a double life. But, you know, at a certain point, I realized I could kind of combine what I had learned in public policy and in African American studies, and have it be a sort of overtone in my comedy life.
Hmm. Well, yes. So there are not that many comics like you. Even if you set aside the Black studies and the public policy part of it, you're an Iranian American Muslim comic. And there are very few Muslim comics. There's very few Iranian American comics.
True.
There's not that even not that not as many women comics, more so today than before. So you sort of occupy all of these bizarre let's just say non-mainstream identities and do it all at once. I mean, I can relate a little bit to that myself, but how do you navigate that? And in fact, does that on the positive side provide you with lots of rich material to talk about in your comedy?
You know, I think the first barrier has always been gender. I think it's really tough to be a woman in this field. And if you look at the lineup of any club, I mean, you could just as an experiment, go look at the comedy club in your own town and look at the lineup and see how many women are on the lineup. And you'll get a sense of how still gendered the comedy world is. It's really weird. And it's 2016. You're sort of like in comedy is such a like you think like a bastion of liberal thought or whatever, but it's still very, very gendered. It's just biased in favor of dude comics. So I spent a fair amount of my time, you know, especially like in college, trying to pass as a dude, you know what I mean? Writing jokes about video games and farts and, you know, to be just stuff that I really wasn't as interested in, but
farts and video games. I think that about covers most of the male centered comedy.
I mean, to be fair, I still enjoy a good poop joke. So that doesn't lie on gender lines. But yeah, I think I tried really hard to kind of pretend like I was a dude for a long time to try and fit in and not make myself seem like I was sticking out. But I was always one of the only women involved in any of like whether it was a sketch comedy troupe or whatnot. And I think now, you know, I think it does. I think what growing up as an Iranian American Muslim, what studying stuff like public policy and African American studies has done is it just gives me a different perspective on the world, which I don't know. I can't feel it, but I'm hoping it translates into more material and material that kind of comes from a different perspective.
So your documentary that you did with Dino Bidala and several other comics was basically based on you touring the country, doing these stand-up performances around the country, filming it and turning it into a documentary. The Muslims Are Coming is the name of the film. And the ad campaign around the film became its own news story, which you write about in your book. Tell us why the ads for this film became so controversial, particularly in New York.
Well, I mean, it was crazy because the movie came out in 2014 on all the digital platforms, including Netflix, and we thought we should promote this Netflix premiere with posters throughout the MTA subway system. And around the same time, that's the subway system in New York City, and around the same time, there was an anti-Muslim hate campaign that was going on, and they had spent over $300,000 to make these really ugly, distasteful and hateful campaigns. And the one thing I can say about bigots is like they have very little design aesthetic. You know, like if they're trying, I think they should up their game on that because if the, you know, they're going to attract more people if the posters look prettier. But anyway, so we thought, okay, let's promote the movie. Let's say funny things about Muslims, and see, you know, we can't spend $300,000 if we don't have it, but let's see what the minimum ad buy is. So we raised $20,000, which would have been the minimum we could raise to spend on these posters with the MTA. We worked with the MTA for over 5 months to get those posters approved, and they were approved. And they were very particular. Like, there's certain words you couldn't use, there's fonts, and like you couldn't use the word poop or genitals. That cut out like half of our material. We were, you know, we worked with them at every step. We wanted to be very accommodating Muslims, and we were. And then the posters got approved, and then 2 days after they were supposed to go up, slated to go up, the MTA actually just said that they were banning the posters, citing political content. And the posters are truly, I'd say, ridiculous. Like, one of them says, "The ugly truth about Muslims, they have great frittata recipes." So, like, that's the kind of tone of the posters. And we thought, how is this political? You know, it's not political. This is just about funny Muslims and that are also like dumb and ridiculous. You know what I mean?
And the anti-Muslim ads were not deemed too political.
And the anti-Muslim ads, they had come in, you know, to the MTA's credit, they actually tried to stop those ads going up, and there was a court order that forced them to put those ads up. So the, you know, the MTA basically has been trying to get out of the business of having anything about Muslims in the MTA. You know, but our point was like, you know, Victoria's Secret puts up images of like a bunch of hot ladies wearing lingerie. How is that different from us just wanting to promote our film? So eventually we've sued the MTA the way a couple of comedians would, and we won. So that's what happened with that. But, it took over a year and a half, and it was a really long, harrowing process. And I don't know if you've ever sued a state agency, but it's not fun.
No, I have not sued a state agency. Now, the documentary, The Muslims Are Coming, was intended to make light of this irrational fear that has existed in the U.S. This was pre-Donald Trump. Enter Trump about a year ago, and all of a sudden, the things that you and your colleagues were talking about in that film seem to become so much more relevant and kind of terrifyingly so. And one of the things that often comes up as an accusation against Muslims by reactionary Americans is that if you don't denounce terrorism, you're with the terrorists, and hence we're all going to sort of paint all of you with one brush of terrorism. And you've taken that on quite strongly. One of the ways in which you've done that is through your daily denunciations online. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, there's a question that I get all the time, and it's, why don't Muslims denounce terrorism? So my response to that was, you know, and I always said, we do denounce terrorism, but let's just, the media is not going to cover a bunch of reasonable people denouncing violence. That's kind of a boring subject. So what I decided to do was set up a website called The Daily Denouncer that denounces terrorism every day of the week, but takes the weekends off. And so the website is just a series of single panel cartoons. And hopefully, you know, we'll be putting out more, you know, and more as the days come. But, you know, and they're just single panel cartoons where you see a Muslim denouncing terrorism in a ridiculously mundane situation. So it's a website that'll hopefully generate a laugh, but also shows that, you know, Muslims denounce terrorism, and that it's kind of ridiculous that Muslims always have to denounce terrorism. I just want a blanket statement: Muslims denounce terrorism. Like, let's put that one to rest.
When you speak and perform, I mentioned you're a TED senior fellow, so you are in front of audiences a lot, and a lot of people are taken aback by just even your appearance. You wear dresses and you have glasses and short hair. There's no, for our radio audience, there's no scarf covering your head. You defy the stereotype, the very sort of reductive stereotype that Americans have of Muslims, that maybe fit a small percentage of real Muslims in the real world. How do you respond to, you know, people's questions that, well, you don't look like a Muslim?
I that's another question I get a lot on the road. And I think, you know, what people don't understand is that the hijab is really up to a lady themselves. Like, you can cover, you cannot cover. Also, I'm a secular Muslim. So I...
What? There's such a thing?
Muslims come on a spectrum, and they're not all, you know, hardcore practicing, just like all Christians are not hardcore practicing, just like all Jews are not hardcore practicing. So that's something that we really tend to forget when we're talking about Islam. For some reason, we kind of view all Muslims as like extreme, like they don't just practice, but they're like, they violently practice. And so that's something that I want to kind of clarify for people, is that, you know, a Muslim can look like me, or they can, you know, look completely radically different from me. It, you know, they come in all shapes and sizes the way every religious group does. And it's just ridiculous to think that they don't. So, you know, in the covering issue, it's like, even for practicing Muslims, you can cover like however you want. It's your own definition of modesty, your own definition of how you should appear in public.
Right.
It's not guided by anything.
There's plenty of Gulf Arab women who underneath their hijab are wearing designer 3-inch stilettos and French makeup.
Absolutely. And then there's plenty of, like, you know, you go to Beirut, there's a bunch of self-identifying Muslims who are wearing, you know, smoking hot cleave and short skirts, and they look like they're in a club in Miami, and they're also Muslim. So, you know, it's to each their own.
How do you make white people laugh, Nagin? On the book cover, you have what looks like a professor showing a bar graph.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you right now, white people like a funny graph, but not a serious graph. I think, you know, the title, part of the kind of tongue-in-cheek nature of the title is that what makes white people laugh is sort of what makes everybody laugh. But also, what's behind the title is that white people control a lot of things, right? So they control, like, space and war and printer ink cartridges and the career of Tom Hanks. There's just a list, you know, of a handful of things that white people control. And I think, you know, it's really important to keep them happy and to keep them laughing, because if they're laughing, they'll be just too distracted to start more wars. So that's kind of the blanket idea behind making white people laugh.
Are you scared by what we are witnessing today with the rise of Trump and people just more openly kind of sharing their anti-Muslim racism?
I am scared. I'm also scared by Brexit. I'm scared about the recent, you know, the recent elections in Austria were like, you know, narrowly a right-wing xenophobe lost. But these are all the winds of hatred, not to sound too sweeping, are upon us. And I think the Trump ascendancy is an example of that. And I feel like if we're able to, you know, if the GOP, which is one of only two major parties in the United States, is able to nominate a blatant racist and a xenophobe and a bigot, where does that leave us? It's very scary. And the numbers are, I mean, he essentially got more votes. He got more votes than the other guys who weren't bigoted.
Or who weren't overtly bigoted, let's put it that way.
Weren't overtly bigoted, right? And maybe it's easier for us to get this kind of candidate who's just saying exactly what he feels, is not trying to sugarcoat it with some kind of, like, you know, some kind of double talk or whatever, where they are bigoted, you know, as you say. So we don't know. So maybe it's easier to kind of treat him exactly as he's, with his pronouncements, you know, but I think it's scary, and it does scare. I think it's scary, and I don't want to mince words. Like, one of the major political parties in the United States has nominated a bigot to the office to as their presidential nominee, and that happened in the year 2016. So it's scary.
What do you make of this? I mean, this ban on Muslims. He doesn't mince words. He wants to ban Muslims from the United States. How would that work? Like, in a future where Donald Trump might be president, how does one ban Muslims from the United States?
Well, I actually tested this out. I went out on the streets of New York City along with MoveOn.org. This is a video you can see online. And I conducted what I called the bacon test. So I basically asked people, are you Muslim? And if they said no, then I would say, prove it. And they'd have to eat from a large pile of bacon. And if they didn't eat from the bacon, then they'd have to sign a Muslim registry, which looked a lot like a bridal registry. It had like flowery writing on it and stuff like that, little stars. And so that was my way of kind of saying, okay, if we're gonna, let's see if we could even put this Muslim registry, this banning of Muslims into practice. It involves a religious test, obviously, because how else would we know who the Muslims are? And I don't know what religious test might be effective, but bacon might be the one.
I mean, I know Muslims who eat bacon, by the way.
I also eat bacon, which you see me doing in the video.
And I know lots of non-Muslims who don't eat bacon for, you know, health reasons. So.
Well, and according to the rules of my test, a vegan would be Muslim.
There you go. And, you know, there's so many other things that Donald Trump just offers to comics to make fun of. I mean, even non-comics. I can't even look at him without wanting to laugh. I mean, he just cuts a ridiculous figure. And you know, somebody like Sarah Palin, who had such trouble putting sentences together, who essentially delivered word salads into her microphone, was excoriated by the press. Do you feel that the media doesn't make enough fun of Donald Trump, that they do take him far more seriously than he deserves, that he's such a ludicrous, you know, person, that it's hard to even think of him as a real person, that he's just this walking caricature of himself?
I mean, I think that Donald Trump has his own plan of saying something crazy and then that crazy thing to get a lot of press attention. And the press is kind of, I think the press just follows his lead way too much. I think the one, you know, there have been moments where, for example, with the Trump University, like we, you know, he started talking about Judge Curiel that was presiding over the case and saying all of the horrible remarks about Mexicans and Judge Curiel. And that to me, you know, and that became the story. The other story is really, what has Trump University done, and is this a scam? And, you know, and really looking at Trump's business practices. And I think, you know, part of it is the public's appetite for stuff that just seems bombastic and gossipy rather than actually looking at his business acumen and looking at cases like Trump University or Trump Steaks or Trump Water or whatever. And maybe those stories just don't get as many clicks. But there are stories out there where you can really look at what Trump, who he is as a businessman. He claims to be a really great businessman, but he isn't. He's had, you know, a bunch of Chapter 11 bankruptcies. And as we know, Trump University is under attack for being, is being scrutinized for being a scam. And so we should really be, there should be more reporting on that stuff. And that will hopefully kind of treat Trump as an actual candidate that has a questionable history.
Now, Nagin, one of the things that allows or enables people like Trump and his supporters to demonize and stereotype Muslims is that Americans just are so ignorant about it. And I know a big part of your work is kind of taking on that ignorance and erasing that ignorance. We just don't see enough diverse and interesting and just kind of everyday normal Muslim characters on television, in movies, in our pop culture. And this is a big problem and that feeds into the stereotyping of Muslims, but it's a problem that Hollywood has the power to do so much about and don't. Now, I understand that you're actually making a feature film that's gonna be out this year where you play the role of, is it a Muslim character? Tell us about your film.
So the movie is called Third Street Blackout, and it'll actually be available nationwide July 5th on all the digital platforms. It's called Third Street Blackout, you'll be able to get it on iTunes, cable on demand, all that stuff. And it's basically a romantic comedy that's set in the blackout after Hurricane Sandy, because in Manhattan, like half Manhattan was stuck in a blackout for 5 days. And during that time, I had a bunch of romantic shenanigans involving a dude, and we would run around town leaving notes on buildings and trying to find each other because there was no text messaging, there was no social media. It was the first time in a long time for New Yorkers where they had to make eye contact and speak with their neighbors. And it was a really kind of beautiful, interesting time. And it was, I think, a silver lining to to that event was that neighbors actually met each other. And in fact, 9 months later, there were a bunch of blackout babies.
Really?
So this in the movie, I think, and you know, I am trying to kind of break the mold with how you see Muslims. And one of my, you know, and this is one of my small efforts of playing the lead in a romantic comedy. Like, how often do you see a Muslim American woman playing the lead in a romantic comedy? It's very, you barely even see anyone who doesn't have like blonde hair being the lead in a romantic comedy. You know what I'm saying? So this, I think, is something we're trying to do. And I also recruited some really amazing comedians in it, like Janine Garofalo, John Hodgman, Ed Weeks from The Mindy Project, Jordan Carlos from The Nightly Show, Rachel Feinstein from Amy Schumer's show. So there's a lot of amazing comedians in the movie, and I think it's really fun. So I hope people will check it out on July 5th.
Well, good luck with the film, Third Street Blackout. Good luck with your book, How to Make White People Laugh. Nagin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
Nagin Farsad is an Iranian-American Muslim comedian, TED Senior Fellow, director and producer of the documentary The Muslims Are Coming. We've been talking about her new book, How to Make White People Laugh. Again, you can catch her upcoming film, Third Street Blackout, in the next few days. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.